The 100 Years' War, the De Guesclin period, French peace problems, 1374. Well, we checked the English issues, so let's see what the French are having issues with. Now, the inner history of policymaking in the period of the 1370s is even more obscure in France than it was in England. Papal legates had consulted Charles V in advance about their proposed conference, and he had given it its blessing, at least outwardly. Charles V was reappraising his war aims. Having recovered almost all the territory ceded by the Treaty of Bretigny, he was willing in principle to compromise with the English for the sake of peace. France had lived through 5 years of almost continuous fighting. The war was expensive and locally destructive. The taxes which supported it were unpopular. Renewed bouts of bubonic plague depopulated villages and towns and made hearth taxes harder to collect. The assizes, which were levied on transactions, intended to fall in times of depression, experienced a sharp reduction in 1373 and 74, from which they would not recover for some years. In spite of the failure of the English arms since 1369, the English were still feared for the damage that they could do to the land of France and to the delicate balance of internal politics. Charles V, although 36 years old, was a sick man. Gouty and unhealthy for many years, he was afflicted in the summer of 1374 by an obscure but apparently serious malady. He was thinking about the political situation which he would bequeath to his 6-year-old son if he died prematurely, and was already preparing the great series of ordinances which would attempt to control the rivalry of his 3 brothers during what might be a long regency. These changes of mood at the Hotel St. Paul coincided with the emergence of tensions within the French royal family. Louis of Anjou remained as uncompromising as ever in his hostility to the English, but he was marginalized by his distance from Paris, by doubts amongst Charles's counselors about his political judgment, and by his facility for making influential enemies. More significant was, as a factor in the French thinking about war and peace, was the personality and ambition of the youngest brother, Philip, Duke of Burgundy. Philip was emerging as the most influential of the royal princes. He was with the king for much of June and July of 1374, when the French response to the papal legate's plan was being considered. His main interest in the peace process arose out of his marriage to Margaret of Flanders, daughter and sole heiress of Louis de Mal. He was on good terms with his father-in-law and listened to him. As the heir to Louis's territories, he was the heir to many of Louis's political preoccupations. He was also a subtle diplomat with an instinct for compromise and an intelligent grasp of the political dilemmas of the English. He had known most of the leading figures in Edward III's court during the long captivity in England after the Battle of Poitiers. Alone among Charles V's counselors, he retained the forgotten commonplace of the early age that royal princes of England and France belonged one cousinhood. Philip of Burgundy became the most persistent advocate at the French court of a negotiated settlement with England, very much as John of Gaunt did for quite different reasons on the other side of the Channel. For the French king, the main problem about the conference lay in its timing and in the English demand for a general truce while it was being organized. The French government wanted to negotiate from a position of strength. In particular, if there were to be negotiations for a permanent peace, it was important to eliminate the surviving English positions outside the heartlands of the Gascony Duchy and the Pale of Calais. In the north, this meant the fortress of Saint-Sauveur-le-Vicomte in the Cantine and the surviving English garrisons at Brest and Auray in Brittany. In the southwest, the military situation was even more delicately balanced. The Duke of Anjou was on the point of invading the Garonne Valley. Garrisons of Luzon, most dangerous of the surviving English enclaves north of the Gascon March, was negotiating for its surrender. Sir Diggory Say was still holding out in the castle of Guinquay at the heart of the Poitou. So was the important walled town of Cognac in the Charente east of the Sens. All of this unfinished business made the timing of any truce a critical issue. When the king received the legates again, about the end of June 1374, he played for time. He told them he needed to reflect. In meantime, he began to make preparations for a fresh military campaign. On about July the 12th, 1374, Pilleo de Pratt's letter arrived at Westminster, reporting that there would be a delay while the French king made up his mind. The English King's Council knew nothing about the French government's plan, but assumed, quite correctly, that Charles V was not interested in freezing the current military balance, and naturally turned to their own projects. The tepid French response tipped the balance on the King's Council in favor of John de Montfort's project. John received the go-ahead for his invasion of Brittany less than a week after Pelayo's messenger had left England. On July the 17th, the first orders were given to requisition shipping for his men. The expedition was conceived on an ambitious scale. The army was to make up 4,000 men under the joint command of John de Montfort himself and the king's son Edmund Langley, Earl of Cambridge. Their personal retinues accounted for about two-thirds of its strength. The rest was provided by the 22-year-old Edmund Mortier, Earl of March, and by Edward, Lord Despenser, an accomplished courtier and patron of Froissart, who called him the finest knight and the most gallant and courteous man in England. This was a gross flattery, but Despenser, certainly an experienced captain, having fought in all the major English campaigns on the continent since 1356. The four captains contracted to serve for a full year in the first 6 months at the king's expense. After that, they would be expected to maintain themselves from the plunder and ransoms of Brittany and France, an echo of Noel's disastrous campaign of 1370, which was likely to destroy whatever goodwill John de Montfort still had amongst his subjects. But the English government was less interested in reestablishing Montfort's authority in his duchy than improving their bargaining power at Bruges by a decisive stroke against the French. The campaign was always seen as a complement to a long diplomatic game. The captain's indentures made express provision for the recall of the army if a truce or peace was made. So when, in the middle of August 1374, the legates finally reported to the English council that Charles V was ready to discuss the general truce in the conference, it was Edward's turn to temporize. The legates were told that the king would need the advice of the leading men of his realm. They had unfortunately dispersed to the country for their holidays. There would be no response until early October. With the optimism that had become habitual amongst English military planners, it was hoped that by early October, John de Montfort's expedition would have already sailed. Well, these decisions came at an exceptionally difficult time for the English government, which was experiencing a cash flow crisis of the kind which was becoming familiar to the harassed officials of the Exchequer. Naval operations in the Channel had been wound down 3 months early in July 1374, and the fleets of both admiralties paid off, leaving only the king's ships and barges and the service of the Cinque Ports to defend the coast. Since the threat from the French and the Castilian fleet was then at its height, financial stringency is likely to have dictated this decision. The Breton campaign presented the Exchequer with a serious financial headache. Most of the cost had to be paid in advance. Upfront payments of more than £32,000 to the troops would be required in the next few weeks, in addition to the wages of the crews of the 200 or so ships which would be needed to carry them across the Channel. In August, the captains were recruiting their retinues in the shires. There was a scramble for ready money at Westminster. A syndicate of London merchants with interests in Calais offered to come to the king's aid with an interest-free loan of £10,000 if the government would agree to enforce Calais' theoretical monopoly of the English export trade. This was thought to be too expensive of a concession, and in the event an even larger loan was made, ostensibly by another London merchant, John Peel, in partnership with the financier Richard Lyons. They combined to lend the government £20,000 to pay the advance due to John of Montfort. It was a characteristically murky transaction. Lyons' participation was real enough, but Peel was simply a front for Latimer. Moreover, only two-thirds of the loan was actually received in cash from the two lenders. The rest sent off against the face value of some ancient royal debt, which the lenders had brought up, presumably at a heavy discount, from the Barty banks and other creditors of the crown. This represented an implicit rate of interest something like 50% a year. Although extortionate on the face of it, this probably represented the going rate for a government whose credit was weak and whose military fortunes were low. More controversial was the source of the money. Some of it certainly came from private fortunes of Latimer and Lyons, both whom were rich men, but as much of it appears to have been taken by Latimer from cash balances of the king's chamber. so that the king was effectively lending money to himself for the profit of his ministers. In round figures, a total of about £46,500, inclusive of interest, was borrowed for the Breton campaign from various ministers, courtiers, and professional financiers between August and December of 1374, of which about £8,800 represented very short-term finances, a matter of days, and about £9,300 was never actually received but settled on account in discharge of an ancient debt. The balance, about £28,400, was new money which was effectively being advanced against the receipts of the following year. So once again, a very interesting mess. So we have both sides trying to get a military expedition going. So next time we'll be looking at the French making the first move. Now the sources for this, The Hundred Years' War, The Chronicles by Froissart, The Hundred Years' War by Perrois, The Hundred Years' War by Nylans, and The Hundred Years' War, The House Divided, Volume 3 by Sumption. So I hope you enjoyed that, and as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.